Chapter 16. Code Blue. The briefing room is waiting. It's crowded. Jez, Lockhart, and Andy are there, obviously. Less obviously needed are the other heads at the back of the room, who bracket just about everyone from the Dresden Rice Committee, including Mary, and also Pete and Alex, neither of whom are remotely cleared for this kind of shit. So I view their presence here as either a sign of desperation or of leaking stovepipes and prolapsed security. "Who invited them?" I ask Andy as I join him at the top table.
"Why don't you ask the ringwraiths?"
Andy murmurs back, swivelling his eyes in the direction of a side door, which is just opening to admit a familiar figure whose mere presence makes my blood run cold and my ward tingle. It is the senior auditor, followed by another of his cabal, middle-aged, female, kind-faced as death in her twinset and pearls.
"Good evening, all,"
announces the senior auditor, looking round the assembled crowd. A quick smile. Light flashes from the gold frames of his half-moon reading glasses.
"Mr. Schwartz, I'm pleased to meet you."
Alex jerks, doing his best guilty schoolboy impression.
"Our patient zero. I've heard a lot about you."
"Charmed,"
says the female auditor, a twinkle as of ice in her eye.
"What is this?"
Alex squeaks, sounding as intimidated as a mouse that has just woken up in the middle of a cattery.
"One moment."
The senior auditor raises his left hand, extends a couple of fingers, reminding me incongruously of a death metal star messing with his audience's head, and utters a word. I don't hear it so much as I feel it, ricocheting back and forth inside my skull like a really angry hornet, getting ready to sting someone repeatedly.
"I declare this meeting room sealed by the authority vested in my office. What is spoken here may not be discussed with those elsewhere, on pain of execution of your oath of office."
I spot Pete huddling in a chair with his arms wrapped around him, looking most unhappy. He's a modern, enlightened vicar of the variety who has a PhD in Aramaic studies. He probably thinks of the whole Bible thing as a fascinating, abstract, historical puzzle, which he has read in the original tongue, at least those bits that survive via the Dead Sea Scrolls. Of course he's unhappy. He's trapped in a committee with a bunch of demonologists and necromancers, the Eater of Souls, two vampires, and a kindly-looking old gent in half-moon specs who scares them all shitless. He must feel like an atheist at a revival meeting.
"I'd like to open this session by announcing that it's a Code Blue emergency briefing. You're all involved, to some extent. Is anybody unclear as to why they're here?"
Hands go up all round the room.
"Yes!"
It's Doris from Health and Safety. My heart sinks. Old Basil the Coffin Dodger is sitting right beside her, sucking on his dentures and rocking slowly.
"What's this about?"
"Ah, Mrs. Green."
The S.A. smiles, apparently in genuine pleasure.
"You're here because you're the Health and Safety Monitor on the Dresden Rice Committee, and I see you brought Mr. Northcote Robinson from Archives along too. How charming. Basil, we really must get together one of these days. It's been too long. The reason for this meeting is somewhat less happy, I'm afraid to say. This lunchtime, we became aware that one of our vampires was missing. I believe James and Mr. Howard are just back from investigating."
Angleton clears his throat.
"Evan Elliott is confirmed dead. Bob identified him. Cause of death was hemoglobic incineration, followed by V. parasite autophagosis. His neck was broken, immobilizing him. The killer then positioned him in front of a window."
He falls silent.
"It was a professional hit," I add. "Whoever did it knew exactly what they were doing and left no forensic traces. There may be CCTV footage from the lobby and the cameras nearby, but I expect the assassin took care to avoid standing too close.
CSI's magic image enhancement software doesn't actually work on real-world CCTV footage. A blurry, low-resolution image, saved at 8 frames a second, won't tell us anything useful about a careful professional who never came within 50 metres of a camera. I'm interrupted by a retching sound. It's Alex, with his head between his knees. Pete is leaning over him, clearly concerned. From across the room, Mary catches my eye. She's clearly upset.
"Would someone care to explain what this means in plain English?"
complains Doris Green.
"As the incident didn't occur on our premises, I don't see how we can possibly be blamed."
"What? What?"
chirps Basil Northcote Robinson. He looks puzzled.
"Please leave your questions for later," says the S.A.
He's still smiling, but there are wrinkles in his forehead and crow's feet at the sides of his eyes.
"I see that Oscar Menendez is not present."
Mary startles.
"That could be significant. I have further bad news. In addition to Mr. Elliot's death, last night Sir David Finch wrote a suicide note, then unscrewed one of the window units in his office and jumped to his death."
Alex seems to have got his rebellious stomach under control, but Mary turns white as a sheet. She looks as if she might start with a head-spinning, pea-soup-spraying thing at any moment.
"Which is extremely convenient. Miss Murphy, do you have any reason to believe that Mr. Menendez might have wanted to kill Sir David?"
"Papa..."
Mary's jaw flaps for a few seconds.
"No, it's too early."
Now she looks ashen.
"He's not ready for the bust-out. Nowhere near."
"Thank you, that will be all,"
the S.A. says, not unkindly. She flops back in her seat, gasping as if she's just swallowed a toad.
"We will discuss his plans further during your next enhanced vetting."
Pale doesn't really describe her right now. Ashen would be a better word. She's shaking, either from fear or anger. I'm not sure whether she's pissed at or afraid of the senior auditor, or freaked because he thinks Oscar might be a murderer. But the S.A. rolls sublimely on, leaving the rest of us floundering in a sea of uncertainties.
"If Mr. Menendez is not responsible for Sir David's death, then we must assume that he is in immediate danger. Gerald, if you'd be so good as to take care of matters, you may leave the room."
"I'll get onto it right away,"
Lockhart says as he heads for the door. I suspect he's relieved to be out of the firing line, with a straightforward task to accomplish.
"Resource level?"
"This is a code blue,"
interjects the female auditor.
"Do whatever is necessary to locate Mr. Menendez and move him to a place of safety."
Mary sticks up her hand.
"There is a Mercedes van,"
she says hesitantly,
"kitted out with food, fuel, and a full bug-out kit. Oscar called it his mystery machine. It's parked in the bank's basement car park on Level B.
She rattles off registration, make, and model details.
"He was prepping a bolt hole somewhere in the countryside. I don't know where exactly. He refused to say."
The auditor beams at her.
"Thank you, Miss Murphy."
She glances at Lockhart.
"Proceed as authorized."
And then Jerry Lockhart is gone, and I suppress a shudder. Did I just hear an auditor tell one of the heavy hitters in external assets to do whatever is necessary? Then I look at Mary. She's wearing a profoundly guilty expression. Is it putting 2 plus 2 together, if I infer that the senior executive she mentioned over dinner was... Oh, well, it's none of my business, I suppose. Especially now.
"I have called this meeting because it has become apparent that someone is attempting to liquidate our Opera Cape employees,"
says the senior auditor, taking over from his colleague.
"This working group, therefore, has 3 tasks. The first item on the agenda is to place all personnel with Fang syndrome who are not members of this committee in protective detention for the duration. The second item is to identify the threat."
"Oh, no," groans Alex. The S.A. chooses to ignore his interruption.
"By establishing a decoy protocol whereby 2 assets will be exposed, albeit with protection."
"Now wait a minute,"
starts Mary.
"And the third action item is to neutralize the threat,"
the S.A. adds, ignoring her too.
"Which means identifying, characterizing, and preventing it. Ahem. There is some reason to believe that it may have resulted from an inadvertent contact with our own organization. This cannot be confirmed at present, but you should be aware that this is why I have established a code blue working group and bound you all to silence. Colonel Lockhart is, incidentally, already privy to this plan.
Colonel Lockhart? Well, I already knew he was ex-army, but that's some heavy stuff. I look around the room. Everybody is looking as grim as a tax audit, except for Mary and Alex, who look petrified, Pete, who is appalled, and the Dresden Rice dead wood, who appear to be wondering what time dinner is served in this nursing home.
Working groups. Green, Northcote Robinson, you are working under Jez Wilson on Task Alpha, securing our human resources. You will coordinate with Colonel Lockhart once he has secured Mr. Menendez. Angleton, Howard, Murphy, Wilson, Newstrom. You are on tasks Beta and Gamma, threat identification and neutralization. Which is to say, you have to identify, track, and intercept a dedicated assassin, who has successfully killed at least one Fang, and quite possibly a senior banking executive.
Everyone looks duly grave.
You will now form breakout groups in this briefing room, and next door, room 203, and conduct a task breakdown exercise and develop proposals for taking the operation forward. Judith and I will coordinate from here. Are there any further questions? No? Very well. Let's get to work.
I end up taking Mary home. My home. Because it's a safe house. No, really. Class 1 secured, and tested the hard way. I do not tell her that the testing involved me being doorstepped by KGB zombies, or articulate just how little faith I put in the Dresden Rice coffin dodgers, who are half of Team Alpha. For now, it's enough for her to know that home is a Victorian mid-terrace owned by the Crown Estates and leased to approved personnel at a rent affordable on a civil service salary. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to staff our offices in central London. With additional security and wards provided by our own facilities management unit, just in case work comes calling. Or we need to take files home that must be protected from the depredations of random burglars. We've got a spare bedroom you can use. Actually, we've got two spare bedrooms. It's a family-sized house with no family to fill it. And if our Mr. X is trying to rub you out, the last place they'll look is under the roof of the guy they set up to kill you. Now, your own apartment is another matter. I don't need to remind her about Evan. She swallows and nods.
Are you sure your wife won't mind?
She'll mind any number of things, I tell her. She'll mind if you smoke in the bathroom. She'll mind tripping over your suitcase in the front hall. And she'll mind if you don't buy your own groceries or keep clogging up the washing machine. But she won't mind you, if you follow. As long as you're a co-worker and it's just for a day or two. Until we neutralize the threat. If the threat is an insider, it's quite likely that they've got access to the Fang's personnel files. It'd explain how they got to Evan. The Alpha Group worked this out. So they offered the Fangs a choice of the duty officer's accommodation, a lumpy bunk bed in an office next to the staff canteen, a cheap room in a travel lodge, or relocation to the village formerly known as Dunwich, where we maintain a whole bunch of training facilities and which has rather good security against intruders. However, I have a nasty, sneaky, suspicious mind, and I am aware of the possibility that our Fang killer might not only be an insider, but that they might be on the inside of the senior auditor's tent, pissing in the communal punch. And under Bob's roof is the very last place that anyone with access to her personnel file will expect to find her lurking. So I am minded to conduct a controlled experiment. I don't think Mary is suicidally inclined, so during a coffee break, an hour into proceedings, I propose this arrangement to her. And because she's neither suicidally inclined, nor any less paranoid than I am, she agrees, on condition she can tell the senior auditor where she'll be bunking first. Which is fine by me, as long as the SA is the only person she tells. If we can't trust the SA, we are so comprehensively fucked that we might as well wind up the organisation and chow down on the poison pills right now. Before heading home, I spend another hour with the Beta Group, working out our plan for the morrow. I have some misgivings about it, largely because it relies heavily on Alex and Pete, both of whom are, in my opinion, undertrained newbies. On the other hand, they'll have me riding shotgun, along with a small battle group of specialists, who will be briefed at the last possible hour to reduce the risk of leaks. And it's all going to be supervised from the new annex by Angleton himself. I'd ask for Johnny Prince and Bashful Incendiary if they were available, but most of our heavy hitters are out of the office this week, presumably hitting heavy things a very long way from home. The Blue Hades negotiations had to come up at the worst possible time. I suspect the SA is taking steps to recall the delegates, but even so, they won't be back in town for at least 24 hours. So, in the meantime, we've got to work with what we've got. Eventually, it turns 9 o'clock, and people are yawning. Let's call it a day, I suggest, and nobody, not even Angleton, demurs. I walk out into the corridor, and a few seconds later, Mary follows me. What now? She asks. Taxi. I don't like the expense. London taxis are not cheap. But there are two of us, and I don't like the exposure of walking.
Okay, she says. Do you have a spare key? What about dinner?
Spare keys at home. I was thinking of Chinese takeaway. She rolls her eyes.
Oh, you. You haven't changed a bit, have you?
We hail a taxi, and after a brief ride, and a cabbie-administered walletectomy, I lead Mary up the garden path, all 2 wheelie-bin-lined metres of it. Watch out for the wards, I tell her as I apply key to lock.
You don't have to warn me. What did you do? Bury an electrical substation under the front step?
The door opens. Come on in. I step inside and turn on the hall lights. We had a problem with unwelcome visitors a couple of years ago, and they really beefed up the security afterwards. I don't tell her about the additional precautions we're taking tonight. The Basilisk camera in my left jacket pocket, or the Glock 17 loaded with banishment rounds in a quick-draw holster in my right. Mary might be back in HR, but I still don't think she's got the full picture about what I actually do these days.
What caused the problem? Jehovah's Witnesses?
Nah, they were easy enough to get rid of. I just made an appointment to discuss the Bible later, then invited Pete round. We've been blacklisted ever since. It was the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh. I rub my right upper arm instinctively. Everything is better with cannibalism and necromancy. She closes the front door and I relax as the defensive ward reactivates itself. For a moment, we had a break in the secure perimeter. But now, we're okay. I begin to shrug out of my overloaded jacket, planning to hang it in the hall, as Mary squeezes past in the direction of the kitchen.
What?
Mary almost levitates out of her Louboutins.
You didn't say you had a cat!
I look round. The cat is lurking on the staircase that runs up one side of the hall, roughly at eye level, staring out at her from between the baluster poles with an expression of concentrated black-eyed malevolence. One paw flops between the rails over the side of the stairs.
I have a cat. Mary, meet Spooky. Spooky, what the hell. You don't have a problem with cats, do you?
No.
She eyes Spooky warily from just out of paw's reach. I can guess what happened. Darkened hall, dark brown carpet, black-furred ambush hunter. Did she go for you?
She nearly gave me a nasal piercing.
Spooky, detecting that she is the subject of attention, rolls on her back and squirms, purring and exposing her ribcage like a hairy man-trap. Mary glares, then walks through into the kitchen, leaving the cat to enjoy her control of the commanding heights.
Huh. This doesn't say Bob to me.
That's because it says Bob and Mo, I point out. Tea and coffee's in that cupboard, milk's in the fridge, bread bin's over there, recycling's under that worktop by the back door. She hasn't put her bag down yet. And now that I'm paying attention, I realise that all she's got is what she's wearing and what's in her handbag. Nobody was planning a sleepover when they woke up this morning. We've got some spare toiletries and a dressing gown you can use, and if you give me a list of necessities, I can pick them up tomorrow and drop them round before Plan Beta kicks off. But first, I need to check the spare beds made up and the blackout curtains are adequate. Let me show you around.
If you don't mind.
She smiles, uncharacteristically diffident.
I'll try not to be any trouble.
What arouses Oscar is the degree to which his kidnapper reminds him of a younger version of his wife, Pippa. They're both skinny blonde chicks with that brittle finishing school lacquer, cheekbones sharp enough to hone knives on, firm, rounded breasts just about bursting out of the top of her cocktail dress, long, stockinged legs that go on forever, arms sheathed in black satin gloves. She has natural blonde hair up in a ponytail, bee-stung lips glistening like... Don't think about it. Pippa's gone slightly to seed in the past few years, rosy-cheeked from the vino, saggy skin and stretch marks from dropping the crotch fruit, skin showing the first wrinkles from overexposure to sea and sun. But this girl could be Pippa's mad-eyed, party-animal, jailbait younger sibling from back in the day, except that Pippa's an only child. Being kidnapped by someone who looks like your wife's demented younger sister in a party frock is a very strange experience, but he's enjoying it so far. Yes, she's got a gun, and she's obviously unstable, but since he became a fang, his senses have become acute. He can smell waves of lust rising off her like steam. If there isn't a puddle in her panties with his name on it, his name isn't Oscar Menendez. And if that minx Mary isn't putting out for him right now, beggars can't be choosers, can they? Even if they're really millionaires, soon to be billionaires. It's all a bit of a joke, really. It had started at 8 o'clock when his cell phone rang. It was the car alarm monitoring service.
I'm sorry to bother you, sir, but did you know your car alarm is going off? According to our tracking system, it's not moving, but someone's opened the door.
Which car? He asked.
It's the Mercedes Vito, sir.
The getaway van. He blinked, taking a moment to remember, relieved that it wasn't the Porsche.
It's still in the car park at...
I'll sort it out, he said, mildly irritated. That's a secure pound under my office. It's probably a false alarm. Can you call me again if it moves? It'll take me a while to get there and reset the alarm. Hanging up, he took the elevator down to the hotel lobby and hailed a cab to the bank. Going to his long-lost place of work for the first time in what felt like years, even though it was only a few weeks, was alienating. It felt even weirder to be making the trip in home casual rather than office uniform. Like a dream, complete with the same sense of something not quite right. Not for the first time, he found himself wondering if buying the van hadn't been a mistake right from the start. The van was an indulgence, also an obligation, and finally, a precaution. He'd bought it as soon as he began to grasp the scope of the opportunity that brilliant fool Alex had presented him with, but before Mary had told him about the laundry. It wasn't his true getaway option, but it was a good enough decoy to convince the rest of the scrum that he was planning to take them with him, and it also served a secondary function. His real getaway option lived in an anonymous wallet in a bottom drawer in his second guest bedroom at home, a genuine Canadian passport with genuine biometrics matching him, in a name nobody he worked or lived with knew about, along with a matching birth certificate and the diamond Visa and MasterCard, both genuine. The wallet's contents had cost him 10 times as much as the van, and would carry 1/10 as many passengers to safety. But the van would do in an emergency, if the bug-out wallet was compromised by an Interpol red alert. Oscar had not got where he was today by skimping on preparations. The scrum were also blissfully unaware of the special fixtures and fittings he'd installed in the mystery machine to support its secondary function. The illegal pistol hidden behind the plastic trim on the front passenger side door. The false number plates and the phlebotomy kit and the body bag folded under the floor of the rear compartment. It behooved Oscar to keep an eye on the van, hence the expensive anti-theft tracking system. Oscar had taken the lift down from the lobby to the underground car park, expecting to find nothing much. Most likely an inconsiderate ass who'd exceeded his recommended daily dose of intranasally delivered vitamin C had backed his Chelsea tractor into the front bumper before screeching off home. Nevertheless, he inspected the van from a distance, then close up, before approaching. Everything seemed to be in order. But as he walked around the driver's side, he noticed an anomaly. The door lock button was raised. Frowning, He opened the door.
Hi, said the woman in the passenger seat. You must be Oscar. Please don't move.
Oscar had blinked. One moment she wasn't there. The next he opened the door and she was beaming at him over the barrel of his own... No, it wasn't his pistol. His was an ancient, battered and very illegal revolver, the best he'd been able to get, given his shortage of low-life acquaintances. This was an automatic, dull and black, with a suppressor protruding from the barrel, like something out of a James Bond movie. Her black opera gloves made it look like a bizarre extension of her arms.
"For your safety and comfort,"
she said in a sing-song voice,
"you should be aware that this gun can shoot straight through the side of this vehicle."
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want you to open the rear passenger door and climb in, then sit down in the right-hand seat and fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be a fun ride.
Bemused, Oscar did as he was told. Then, because he had to try, "Please point that gun somewhere else," he asked, putting just a bit of mental push behind the words.
I don't think so.
She was still smiling. A fey, secretive expression, as if it was a great big joke they shared.
Doesn't work on me, lover boy. Is your seatbelt tight?
Oscar swallowed. Is she a vampire? He wondered.
What is this?
Put these on.
She produced a pair of handcuffs.
Then we're going for a drive. A magical mystery tour. Isn't that wild?
The handcuffs featured a fake leopard skin lining. Still bemused, Oscar clipped them around his right wrist.
And the left, dear,
she said. He put his left wrist in the cuff, leaving it loose. Then something happens. A blur. He blinks, and she's standing next to him in the open doorway, gun out of reach and her left hand on his wrist, the cuffs closed and locked. They're the modern kind, with a rigid steel bridge. The door slides shut and slam locks, and he peers out through the dark-tinted glass as she walks forward and climbs into the driver's seat.
No one outside can see anyone in here except the driver, she says.
Oscar shakes his head, but the glamour she's hit him with overpowers his scepticism. He's sprouting an erection, as if being kidnapped at gunpoint and handcuffed in the back of his own engine of abduction is a turn-on. The knife edge between sex and death is very sharp. She slides the keys into the ignition. Somehow she's taken them from him. Then starts the engine and carefully pulls out of the parking bay. As the van climbs the exit ramp, she starts to sing in a passably good voice.
I think we're alone now.
She drives for a long time, out into the back roads of Hertfordshire, until she finds a suitable place to park. The north gateway leading to a field, at the end of a lane half a mile from the nearest bus stop. Then she climbs into the back of the van and has her way with Oscar. He disappoints her by ejaculating almost immediately. She frowns in distaste.
Kiss, kiss,
she chides him as she breaks his neck. Then she rides him until she comes repeatedly, eyes squeezed shut, shuddering in triumphant dominion. Afterwards, she cleans up the crime scene as usual. The last thing she does is to turn Oscar's paralyzed head to face the open passenger door. It's facing east, and the sky is black and cloudless, sprinkled with stars. She kisses him on lips that still sense and move, trying breathlessly to form words, even though he has no control over his lungs. Then she walks away towards the bus stop, leaving him paralyzed and alone to face the dawn. She wonders what her new patron wants her to do next. She hasn't had this much fun in years. Now pay attention. We have a plan, and the plan is simple enough. Someone is stalking and killing our hemophagously inclined employees. We believe there is an inside connection, and they know where the fangs live. More speculatively, the inside connection may be a very old, very sneaky fang who doesn't like the competition, or the attention they're drawing, or who manipulated them into existence as an experiment and who has now decided they are surplus to requirements, or who has stolen them from some other very old sneaky fang with some other scheme in mind. Obviously, we want to protect our people, hemophagous or otherwise. After all, if we can't even protect our people, what does it say about our ability to meet our operational targets? Also, If you ever want to see a self-kicking conga line, tell a security organization that for the past 40 years, someone has been manipulating its information flow from the inside. Anyway, we intend to place all but one of our fangs out of reach, then build an ambush for whoever or whatever goes after the only available target, who will look like an easy kill because normally they would be. However, anyone who goes for Alex is going to have to come at him across a prepared killing ground, guarded by me and an entire Oculus team, including a couple of bricks from the Special Reconnaissance Regiment, and through a security cordon controlled by SO-15, the Met's Counter-Terrorism Command, who are there to ensure that the SRR and SAS heavies get to do their stuff without drawing undue attention. That's the theory, the easy part. The hard bit is how to go about exposing our tethered goat without actually tipping off the adversary that it's a trap, as my archival inquiries have almost certainly activated a tripwire. That's going to be hard, as all the surviving fangs, except Oscar, who, as of my departure from the office, is still missing, are under cover or locked down. We've effectively served notice on our adversary that we know they're out there. It's hard to see how we could have avoided it, in view of their very public disposal of Evan and Sir David. So our exposure of the bellwether has to look like some kind of accident, and we have to present an easy enough target to tempt the killer out of hiding, but not such a juicy one that their suspicions are aroused. Even if our adversary is an insider and takes the bait, I give it only about a 25% probability of working. And once it fails, we're going to be in a world of hurt. At that point, we run out of options other than a plonkingly obvious inquisition and witch hunt. Witch hunts are a reliable way of devastating organization morale, squandering human capital, and uncovering lots of trivial stuff that we didn't want to have to officially pay attention to. They generate a boom in business for circular firing squads, but don't achieve anything useful, and will ensure we render ourselves operationally incompetent for the next 6 months. We can't afford to lose 6 months. Time is money that comes out of one particular purse we can't afford to spend, even if we succeed in winkling out the fang killer in the shadows. We are in Case Nightmare Green days, and the next threat we have to deal with might be one of the existential anthropic kind, which is to say, the variety where you have to get it right the first time because there is no second chance. Which is why the senior auditor, bless his heartless, twinkly-eyed smile, chose the Pete and Alex show as the main draw for our vampire hunter carnival. As he points out with inexorable logic,
Mr. Menendez is unavailable. Ms. Murphy may be presumed to be a hard target due to her prior experience within the organization and incompatibility with the modus operandi that was used on Evan. This goes for Janice Hill, too.
Mary suppresses a snigger.
So our candidates are Dick, John, and Alex. Alex is fully briefed and seconded to this working group because he was available. The principle of minimizing operational exposure suggests we should use him.
The SA smiles brightly at Alex, who cringes beneath his gaze.
Don't worry. Your utility to us as bait will be severely impaired if we allow any harm to befall you. So that's not going to be allowed to happen.
Hang on a moment, I interrupt. Isn't this several notches above Alex's competence? He hasn't even been assessed for active operational service. And Reverend Wilson, it feels really odd to be using Pete's official day job title, is almost certainly not equipped to deal with... I trail off. The senior auditor is looking at me. It feels a bit like being an amoeba on a microscope slide, pinpointed by million-watt searchlights and observed by a vast, unsympathetic alien intellect.
The adversary will make no attempt to take the bait on organization premises,
the SA points out with complete self-assurance.
He will wait until his prey is off-site. I believe...
The SA glances sidelong at Pete, and I take a shuddering breath of relief.
You have a work assignment that takes you to the KGB-2YA archive in Watford on a regular basis, and that Dr. Schwartz is assisting you. Is that correct?
What? You mean the magic circle of safety stuff?
Pete looks momentarily confused.
Yes, that's right. Why?
Tomorrow afternoon, after dark, you will take Dr. Schwartz for a ride out to the warehouse,
the senior auditor tells us.
Mr. Angleton will take control of the security cordon around the new annex prior to your departure. You will be provided with a covert escort under Mr. Howard's control, and the target area will be adequately prepared for our ambush team to move into position upon your arrival.
He smiles reassuringly.
We will ensure that your movements are well trailed, but no more than 3 hours in advance. If the bait is not taken, you will simply retrieve the items Reverend Wilson needs to continue his project, then return to the new annex. And if the bait is taken, we'll be waiting.
He looks straight at me.
The rest is up to you, Mr. Howard.
A phone rings, and a voice answers.
Hello?
George, it's me.
What is the...
A pause.
Yes?
The wheels have come off, I'm afraid.
The... Tell me. Speak. Now. I command you.
Marianne has dispatched two of the new brood, and she and I are going to take care of two of the others in the next day. However, a problem has arisen. The laundry are now officially aware that someone or something is stalking their new intake. And when I say the laundry, I mean the Invisible College. Word has travelled all the way up the ladder.
Another pause.
Well, that tears it.
There's still time to cauterize the canker before it putrefies, George. But I can't do this on my own. You'll have to move, and move fast. Marianne and I are luring our next targets away from the security cordon, and we have dragged a lot of their guards along for the ride. It's an ambush, in case it isn't obvious. But we can only keep them away from the new annex for about 2 hours. Then the entire house of cards will collapse.
Bastard! You planned this. You set me up.
Not well enough, I'm afraid. The best-laid plans of mice and men, etc. It's all very unfortunate. Someone needs to go into the new annex office building and liquidate the control team that the laundry has established to stalk us. For obvious reasons, it cannot be me.
Tightly.
What can I expect to find?
Two auditors. One DSS, who I know nothing about. He's not in the declassified archives. A bunch of chair warmers. And the site security I outlined in the briefing document.
You'll owe me for this.
Yes, yes, of course. But can you do it? Or have the decades of sitting on your arse in your nice warm club rotted the sinews, old chap?
You'll owe me blood.
Click. At precisely 5:30 the next afternoon, two helmeted figures slip out of the side entrance of the new annex, slink down an alleyway, then unchain and climb aboard a tricked-out Vespa. The rider, Pete, seems no more or less suspicious than is to be expected, but the passenger, Alex, is clearly as twitchy as a twocker, who suspects a police stakeout. It's not surprising. Pete, after all, isn't the tethered goat in this scenario, he's just the driver. But it's worrying. I watch them via a battery-powered wireless webcam glued to the shutters on the betting shop opposite the alley entrance. I'm sitting in front of a laptop in the cramped back of a bright crimson box on wheels that proclaims itself to be a City of London Fire Brigade Major Incident Command Vehicle. It's not. It's an Oculus truck. Fire Incident Command Vehicles don't carry wiry-looking taciturn guys in black webbing and urban nighttime camo uniforms, or an unfeasibly large number of guns. Decoys moving, I announce. I'm wearing a headset and mic and a webbing camo outfit of my own, albeit lighter on the guns and heavier on the occult accessories. Turning left, left, left into the high street.
On it. Moving out.
The narrator is Scary Spice, who I've worked with on other occasions, and who currently doesn't have any army rank, I understand. He's some sort of civilian contractor, having graduated from being a sergeant in the territorial SAS a couple of years ago.
Eyes up, guys.
There's a loud rumbling noise from somewhere in front, as our driver guns the engine, then a distant wail of air horns as he switches on the blues and twos. I had to warn Pete. Do not be tempted to shoot amber lights or exceed the speed limit. Remember, you're leading a 12-ton truck full of men with guns, who will be very annoyed if they lose track of you, but not as annoyed as Alex will be if they lose track of him and our adversary doesn't.
Spoil sport, the vicar snorted. As if I'd do that.
We drive for about 50 minutes, heading north and then east, until we hit the North Circular at rush hour. The North Circular moves for no man, even if he's got flashing blue lights and enough firepower to start World War Z. Inevitably, we lose Pete and Alex for a while. But then I get a call from the Traffic Ops Control Room for North London, where our friends in blue are keeping a special eye open for a vicar and a vampire on a Vespa. They're also keeping an eye on the warehouse via CCTV, but we don't want any obvious watchers on site before we arrive, lest they spook the target. The North Circular is okay for this sort of long-distance tale. It has more traffic cameras than Spooky the Cat had fleas. I relay to the cab. He's about a kilometre ahead of us, still on the A406 westbound, due to turn right onto Nesden Lane North. My phone rings. It's Pete. He's got a hands-free helmet.
Hi, Bob. I seem to have lost you. Where are you? I'm going to pull over.
No, don't do that. We've got you on camera. You're about a kilometre ahead of us. We're stuck in that tailback on the North Circular you passed a couple of minutes ago. You should on no account stop moving. If necessary, if we haven't gotten free of this, you should ride on past the Watford turnoff, join the M25 anti-clockwise at junction 21A, then leave it again at 1A and take Western Avenue back in until you hit the North Circular again. But don't stop moving. If you stop, you become a target. Do you copy?
Don't stop, loop around the M25 and North Circular if you can't shake the traffic.
I feel a sudden lurch as the big truck begins to move again.
Got it.
He disconnects. I don't cross my fingers or clutch my non-existent rabbit's foot, but I check my ward, a heavy-duty item I checked out this morning, pat the belt holster with my G17, and take a deep breath. Mo will kill me if I let anything happen to Pete. Hell, she nearly killed me already, just for asking him to read a dubious Bible translation. Someone nudges my shoulder.
You okay, Bob?
Asks my neighbour. It's Warrant Officer Howe, and if he's sounding concerned rather than ripping my lungs out through my left ear, I must be a pretty picture. Either that, or he's afraid I'll go non-linear, like the way things turned out that time at Brookwood. I dredge up a reassuring smile from somewhere.
Pre-op nerves, I say. I'll be okay once it shakes down.
More juddering and acceleration and braking as we roll along, doing the lights and siren thing. My phone rings again.
Bob?
It's Pete.
I have you in my rearview mirror, so I'm proceeding to the warehouse. Bye.
Decoy has us in sight and is proceeding to target location, I announce over the intercom.
Wait one, says Scary. Please repeat.
Decoy confirmed he has us in rearview mirror and is accordingly proceeding to target location, I repeat.
Negative, Howard. Decoy is out of sight.
What? I stop. Obviously, there's more than one fire engine out and about tonight. I'll check with traffic control. I start poking at the airwave radio, trying to remember my cop speak. Why didn't we slap a GPS transponder on the bike? Don't be silly, Bob. It takes time to requisition those things, and if everyone does their job properly, it won't be necessary.
Scooter registration LB59KPT is on the A411 London Road, northbound towards Watford,
the dispatcher tells me. Well, shit. That puts Pete well ahead of us. He'll be there almost 5 minutes before we catch up.
Is there any way to make this thing go faster?
I ask Scary. Meanwhile, I speed dial Pete on my phone. And that's where Murphy's Law takes over, because he picks up the phone and the call drops immediately. I dial again. And again. The third time it goes straight through to voicemail.
Hello, you have reached the voicemail of the Reverend Peter Wilson. I'm sorry I'm not able to speak right now. If you leave a message, I'll get back to you as soon as possible. In the meantime, you may find these parish numbers helpful.
Decoy's phone not responding, I tell everyone. We've lost contact.
Okay, hang on to your nads,
says Scary.
Hit it,
he adds, possibly forgetting that he has a hot mic. The driver floors the accelerator and tries to bounce my brain out of my skull. I just hope we haven't left it too late. Pete pulls into the small car park behind the KGB 2YA warehouse and switches off the ignition. He looks around. It's dark, and the industrial estate is nearly deserted, dimly lit by sodium lights that cast long shadows across the concrete and tarmac. The metal-clad buildings hunch like the shells of long-dead giant tortoises. There's a single cheap hatchback car parked out in front, and a cheerful light glows from the office window beside the front door. Pete climbs off the scooter, then holds the handlebars while Alex disentangles himself and fumbles with his helmet strap.
"Is this it?"
he asks anxiously.
"Where is everyone?"
"It's always like this, apparently," Pete replies, looking round. "And don't worry about the others. Bob had let us know if they were delayed again."
"Well, I don't like it,"
Alex shivers. He's been doing a lot of that lately, and not because he's cold. As a regular cyclist, even in winter, he's used to it. His hoodie and trousers are up to the job of keeping him warm on the back of a bike. But he's still suffering from the culture shock of having migrated from academia into the pressure cooker intensity of the scrum, and the laundry is even worse in some ways, combining the dingy institutional conservatism of a particularly stuffy Oxbridge college with the stuff of nightmares. It seems to be staffed by a curious mixture of battle-axe civil servants, slightly demented CS math geeks like Howard, and scary old men who smile at you in a way that is simultaneously friendly and horrifying, like a hangman sizing you up for a noose. And then they explain that some lunatic is trying to kill you, has in fact already murdered Evan quite horribly, and that they expect you to quietly walk in front of a bus to see if the driver hits the brakes in time. And you can't seem to think of a reason to say, "Fuck, no!" before your hands are fumbling with a motorcycle helmet and you're sitting on a scooter behind a vicar and then facing a locked door on an industrial estate with who knows what beyond it. Alex makes a complex gesture with the fingers of his left hand in the privacy of his jacket pocket. Then he pulls out his hulking great tablet of a phone and discreetly fires up an app he flung together in a frenzy of focused hacking overnight, and which he hasn't told anybody about. Because, well, if they won't take him into their confidence, why should he take them into his? "Let's go in," suggests Pete. He steps forward and pulls out a bunch of keys. Then he pauses and pushes the intercom button. Pushes it again. There's a brief crackle. "Wilson and Schwartz from Capital Laundry Services," he says. The lock buzzes, and he pushes the door open, pocketing his keys again. He glances over his shoulder just once. "That's funny," he says. "I wonder where they are. It's jolly hard to hide a truck that size." Alex follows, pushing the door wide open, and steps across the threshold. At once he feels a pricking in his fingertips, and a buzzing like angry wasps in the small leather fetish bag they made him wear on a thong around his neck. His pupils dilate.
"Something's wrong,"
he begins to say. Everything seems to take forever. There is a desk and a chair in the office behind the door, and the chair is occupied by a dead man, head lolling, eyes staring vacantly at the ceiling. The man in the chair is not alone. A tall, slim woman stands over him. Blonde hair, black leather jacket, black leggings. This is what Alex notices before he gets as far as the pistol she's holding in one blue plastic-gloved hand.
"Kiss, kiss, boys,"
she smiles, sweet as rat poison.
"Over there, please."
She makes a minute gesture with the gun.
"You," to Pete, "kick the door shut."
Alex knows very little about guns, beyond the basics, that they're machines for making holes in people, and being shot apparently hurts a lot. But it looks very black, and there's a fat cylinder sticking out in front, which can't be good.
"Are you going to kill us?"
asks Alex, unable to keep a quaver out of his voice.
"No."
Her smile turns sour.
"Not that I don't want to, you understand, but orders."
"Don't provoke her," murmurs Pete.
"Oh, I'm unprovocable."
Her hearing is acute, too.
It's my vocation to cleanse the world of things like you.
Another smile, teeth aggressively bared.
Of bloodsuckers and their enablers.
Why?
Alex asks, voice rising.
I haven't done anything to you.
If sheep had guns, would they tolerate the farmer just because he hasn't done anything to them yet?
She motions with the pistol in the direction of the closed inner door.
Open the door. Go inside. Close the door. Don't make me impatient.
What if I say no?
Asks Alex, just as Pete tries to say, You don't have to do this, truly.
Open the door, go inside, and close the door. Or I will shoot you in the kneecaps and drag you through the doorway myself.
Her sudden vehemence makes Alex jump. Pete reaches for the door handle.
What's on the other side?
He asks.
Fucking do it.
She raises the gun, holding it two-handed, her eyes burning.
I'm going! I'm going!
Pete opens the door and shuffles through. Alex twitches, then cringes after him when he sees her expression. It's the hunger of a tiger on a choke chain, in sight of its next meal but not permitted to approach. A moment later, the door closes with a click. The woman, who is not called Marianne, relaxes slightly. She crosses the room and hurriedly turns a key in the lock on the inner door. She returns her pistol to an inner pocket. Then she sits down on the edge of the desk to wait for the next victims to show up, shivering with joyful anticipation. Her new patron has promised her his leftovers. If there is one thing worse than vampires, it would have to be vampire hunters. Consider, vampires are obligate predators. If they try not to feed, eventually the V parasites get hungry and chow down on the host. Prudent vampires do not feed indiscriminately and try to minimize their chances of being caught by picking one victim at a time and fasting as long between victims as possible. But they are, of necessity, serial killers. Vampire hunters, on the other hand, a vampire hunter is a serial killer who hunts serial killers. Not only that, the serial killers they hunt are supernaturally strong ritual magicians, with mind-control chops and an aptitude for occult magic. So I think it's reasonable to say that vampire hunters either have an extremely short life expectancy or constitute one of the most deadly threats you are ever likely to encounter. They are invariably howling at the moon, stark raving bonkers, and not in a good way. Nobody who wasn't several screws short of a full set would ever consider hunting vampires for business or pleasure. Especially because vampires don't exist, right? Right. We are not talking Buffy here. Paging Dexter, Dexter to the white courtesy telephone. Both Buffy and Dexter are fictional characters, and kind of cute, because their creators want to entertain you, not scare you to death. The real thing is something else. Having established that vampire hunters are a whole bundle of no fun at all, it's also important to bear in mind that vampire hunters can sometimes be a vampire's best friend. Consider that the first law of the vampire club is that, if I can see you, I will kill you. But killing in person is messy, dangerous, and can backfire horribly. The risk of overexposure is very real. So smart, experienced, ancient vampires collect vampire hunters wherever possible. Cherish them, feed them, keep them in a cotton-wool-lined box, and only take them out when it's time to point them at a rival and pull the trigger. Do I need to draw you a diagram to show the relationship between old George, the fangfucker who is not called Marianne, and our mysterious adversary inside the laundry, not to mention inside a crypt not far from the tomb of Karl Marx? Yes? Well, it gets complex, like one of those optical illusion 3D triangles that tries to turn your eyeballs inside out if you stare at it for too long. Let's just say that right now they are all using each other for their own ends. George created Marianne as a proxy to kill rivals for him. The rival has gaslighted him into loaning her to him. Marianne is happy because the rival is feeding her playdates. The rival, for his part, is using Marianne and George for his own ends in turn. and if any of them ever slip up in one another's presence, they will die. Which brings us back to the scenario I am describing. Not Marianne is working for a new employer, who has asked her to guard a warehouse door. She has just herded a newbie vampire, and a vicar, by way of innocent bystanders, through it, into the presence of our internal adversary, who has secured her cooperation by promising them to her when he's finished. Which is to say, he's neatly detached her from old George, who will now have to run his own bloody-handed errands. And he's manoeuvred old George into a position where the only way to safety lies through the new annex. Things are about to get very messy indeed, for blood on the walls values of messy.